Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it's 1:22 PM, the Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 14th. And let's take a look at the 10-year Treasury yield today, because it popped on the upside right off the beginning of trading, then gave it all up again, and then recouped the loss and finished at a new high for the day. So the Treasury yield was up 4 basis points. So we can also then think about where was it. It was down to 1.1%. 1% would be, I think, an important area of support, because it offered so much resistance earlier. And of course, this is on the back of the incoming Biden administration floating out the idea that they are prepared to introduce a $2 trillion stimulus package. Of course, there isn't a lot of visibility yet on what they intend to spend the money on. But I suppose we could anticipate that they'll send out a couple of $1,000 to regular individuals. They may look at supporting the Green Initiative. Then there is, of course, the potential for a solution to the looming debt problems of a number of Democrat-controlled states. It's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that they aim to supplement the budgets of some of those states so that they don't become insolvent, because that's a very clear and present risk as we look at what the future holds. Well, when we think about what's likely, I continue to think that some form of yield curve control is inevitable, because as yields rise in absolute terms, then the cost of servicing the debt increases too. This isn't quite the same for individuals. When we think about mortgage rates, well, a mortgage is, at least in the USA, is fixed rate. So when people take out their mortgage, they're locking in their 2.9%, which is really very accommodative. And doesn't really matter what happens to yields after that. They're still going to be paying 2.9% for the next 30 years. Now we can also think about the government, let's first think about corporations. A large number of corporations took out a shed load of debt over the course of 2020. They built up very significant war chests because they were fearful of what the impact of the pandemic was going to be on their businesses, and they thought that they would need that money to tide them over. I don't think that they were quite intending to, at the same time, refinance all of their outstanding debt, but the reality is that's what has been accomplished. So the maturity wall for corporate debt that was due to be an issue in 2021 and 2022 has been pushed out, and the average duration on corporate debt has now also increased substantially to about 7 years. Now, from the perspective of the borrower, that is wonderful news. Corporations are now in a great position. They don't have to go back to the debt markets for large quantities of refinancing debt anytime soon. But from a buyer's perspective, then that longer dated debt is much more interest rate sensitive. So it's not really a great deal from the perspective of those borrowers, particularly if we move into an inflationary environment. But of course, then when we think about the impact of higher yields on governments, well, governments have an ongoing financing requirement. Not only do they have to refinance the yield curve as it becomes or as it approaches maturity, but then with governments running epic deficits, when we think about the fact that the US government increased its debt to GDP ratio last year by 27%. Well, we might say, well, okay, some of that was because the economy contracted, but a lot of it was because of the massive quantity of debt overall. And with an ongoing financing requirement, interest rates matter, because it impacts and has a material impact on the cost of servicing the debt, which, as yields rise amounts to percentages of GDP. And when we're starting to talk about percentages, well, then if money is going out the door paying for the servicing costs of the debt, well, it's not being spent on education, hospitals, or any other way of spending that money. So it's inevitable that eventually the Federal Reserve is going to have to step in and depress yields overall. Now, we are probably likely to see that when we eventually get some evidence from the stock market that liquidity is starting to tighten. Now, one thing I find rather interesting, and my gut says to me that the NASDAQ is susceptible to weakness. The hedge short was stopped out 4 days ago with the pop above 13,000, or 5 days ago, but we haven't seen a move higher here. And this is a very wedgy type of market, where we can see here that there is this sequence of higher highs, and we still have the sequence of higher reaction lows, but the amplitude of the range is narrowing. So a massive reaction against the prevailing trend could easily come back down and test the region of the trend mean. We've had a significant loss of momentum for the NASDAQ 100, but it is worth considering, well, what's in the NASDAQ 100? And I think increasingly, if we look at Europe and we look at what's happening in the USA, well, the tide is turning in terms of consumer sentiment towards some of these extremely large companies. And Amazon has certainly lost upward momentum. Microsoft is also trading at an extraordinary valuation, and it has lost momentum. So we're definitely starting to see a very clear, or some clear evidence of a rotation. Then, of course, we've got this ongoing talk about regulating the social media venues like Facebook, and it pulled back below the trend mean in here today. Twitter has got an interesting business model where they have banned their biggest customer, so the share continues to contract, and it had been on the cusp of breaking out of a six-year base formation, and this is looking increasingly like a failed upside break. When we think about Google, I think it's probably the least encumbered of the main FANG stocks by what's going on in the political sphere, but yet it has at least stopped rising. Netflix is one of the most capital intensive of those companies, with the least potential to generate revenue, and it has also lost momentum and now back in the region of the trend mean as well. Against that background, the Russell 2000 continues to push new highs, and this has been an incredibly explosive breakout overall. We're definitely seeing a lot more interest in the small cap sector, and that extends out to the pink sheets, where companies with less information generally that tend to be much less liquid are surging in value. When there's $1 trillion traded in value in some of these shares in a 24-hour period, it's really indicative of incredible interest in a sector. So small caps continue to do really rather well overall, but the large caps are exhibiting some weakness. So we're certainly seeing some rotation coming through. Now, the dollar was also weaker in here today, but not in a dynamic manner. So it didn't have much of an impact on Wall Street overall. Now, when we do think, though, about rotations out of the extraordinarily large cap sector, well, Europe is a potential beneficiary. And the big change we've seen over the course of the last few months is that Europe is now able to rally despite the fact that it has a strong currency. And that hasn't been true for nearly a decade. And it is a very material change overall. And it's exactly the same for the Nikkei and Japan. The Nikkei has broken on the upside. It's completed a three-year first step above the base. This looks like a new bull market overall, despite the short-term overbought condition. And the pattern of outperformance by the yen remains intact. There is a clear downward bias to trading for the dollar over the course of this year, but it's not just this year. This downward trend, modest as it might be, has been in play now for approximately 4 years, and arguably since 2015. Now, the Bank of Japan has been willing to cap the advance in the yen, but their resolve would appear to be easing because this trend is really very well defined. It looks like it's inevitable that we're eventually going to see the dollar breaking downwards. Of course, in the current environment, there is no country wants a strong currency. So we are at a point where we're getting competitive devaluation. China's trade surplus is surging higher. They have certainly got an outbreak of the coronavirus in a number of different states right now, and there's a lockdown underway in Hubei province. But the reality is that exports are surging, and that is creating a demand for shipping that we haven't seen in years. It's also helping to support upward pricing for the Baltic Dry Index, and that popped on the upside again yesterday. It's also helping to feed demand for commodities. Now, when we think about industrial resources, well, the London Metals Index has been ranging for a really very lengthy time, and it hasn't been able to sustain a move above 3,500 since 2011. But the FTSE 350 Mining Index tends to have a very similar pattern overall to the Metals Index, and it has clearly broken on the upside. So this completes the base formation, and it suggests that we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment overall for mining companies. But then when we look at agriculture, well, the reality is that it isn't simply about commodity prices. These are also foodstuffs. And I think that this is an appropriate index to pay attention to because it includes the contango costs. So despite the fact that we have base formations in a large number of agricultural commodities that have now been completed, the sector overall trended downwards from 2010. And it was hampered by the contango costs, which just took lumps out of it on every contract change. Now that trend has clearly been broken. And when we think about what the outlook is for soybeans, wheat, and rough rice, which are the primary foodstuffs, they are outperforming in no uncertain terms. Soybeans tacked on another 23 in here today. Rough rice was also quite firm, and wheat prices continue to steady in the region of the upper side of the base formation. So as we think about what that means, then we've got incredible commonality right across commodities overall. It isn't just any longer that we have industrial resources doing well, but agriculturals are also doing well, and energy is also continuing to recover. And I think when we think about what's likely in energy, it's the one commodity where there's plenty of supply. So it's unlikely to be the sector that outperforms. But then when we think about natural gas, it's probably going to be one of the primary beneficiaries of this Green New Deal. And the natural gas price, though, is in this long-term base formation, and it would really need to sustain a move above $6 in order to complete it, because it's been in this range for a decade already. That's creating new demand. It's new demand for power production in preference to coal. It's also creating a demand for home heating and for cooking in emerging markets. But the big new development is in hydrogen, and it's still the primary source of supply for hydrogen. Plug power is rising faster now than either Tesla or Bitcoin. The share has more than doubled in the last week, and it does speak to the emerging mania that we're seeing in the hydrogen sector. It's occurring a lot quicker than I was initially anticipating. But we're definitely seeing some incredible advances in the hydrogen sector at present because investors are willing to bet that we're going to have a great deal of investment and that there is going to be a clear commitment by the excuse me governments of the world to pioneer a new green future. And emissions pricing has broken out to new all-time highs, and this is a government mandated price. So they want emissions to be more expensive. Of course, when we think about how they're going to generate new income, as we think about what's likely in terms of yield curve control and government spending, well, there will have to be additional revenue-raising measures. So the burden for those measures will come in the form of taxes. And taxes will fall on wealthier individuals. They're quite likely to fall on corporations because it's considered that corporations have the funds to pay the taxes. Those taxes may come in the form of regulatory taxes, such as emissions, rather than outright corporate taxes. But the reality is that with emissions prices breaking on the upside, that does appear to be the clearest trajectory for additional tax raising measures. So we're in a situation that's quite similar to what we saw in the 1940s through to the 1960s, and then from the early 1970s through to the 1980s, where there is negative real interest rates overall. So interest rates will be held below the prevailing inflation rate indefinitely. Even if interest rates rise, they will not rise in tandem with the inflation rate. There will be clear intentions by government to placate rest of populations. And with agricultural commodity prices rallying, then there is the clear potential that that is going to result in additional social unrest. Just because we've seen a notable incident in the last week does not mean that it's over. In fact, there's the potential that the overrunning of the Capitol building in the USA will act as inspiration for other restive populations around the world. And with agricultural prices pushing on the upside, then there's going to be a motive force behind revolutionary movements as well. So that is obviously something that would have to be priced into markets. But the reality is as long as liquidity remains abundant, then what we are likely to see is additional asset price inflation. Wells Fargo is in the process of completing a Type 2 bottom. We have the acceleration on the downside, the loss of momentum, the failed downside breaks, and now a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And that is on the expectation that they will be allowed to start growing their balance sheet once more. The one thing that was missing from the financial system in the aftermath of the credit crisis was a credit multiplier effect from banks lending. Banks were unable to lend despite the size of their balance sheets because they had, or the amount of money that was being thrown at them because they were trying to rebuild. And that process has been completed, but now you have much more conservative banks. They're not going to lend unless they have clear permission, and backstops from the government. We had an example of what that looked like during the pandemic, where money was thrown to banks, they were told to lend, and that if the money was not repaid, they would be made whole. So they lent with abandon. But that is likely to be the pattern of what we can anticipate. It's not no longer simply that we're going to have modern monetary theory, that there's going to be this not simply an implicit but a formal relationship between the Treasury and the central bank. But the bigger picture is that there will be an additional arm to that kind of agreement, which is that the banks will be supported in their credit multiplier efforts, so that government and central banks will get more bang for their buck in terms of leverage in the financial system. That's part of the reason why banks are pushing on the upside. And JP Morgan pushed on to a new all-time high in here today. There is some speculation that banks like Goldman Sachs may eventually be taken private. And I think that's also one of the reasons why it is pushing on to new all-time highs as well. Of course, there is also the fact that because of the regulatory burden that some of these banks were put under, then the kinds of businesses that they were traditionally involved in, which was market making, have been taken up by other private entities. So if they want to get back into those kinds of businesses, they're probably going to have to go private. And when we think about the success of Citadel Securities, for example, that they're basically doing and picked up the business that the big investment banks were no longer able to do. So we have effectively, over the course of the last decade, separated investment banking from retail banking. And that does allow the retail banks, even though they still have substantial other arms, that they can then go along and participate in this financing effort by the government. So we're likely to remain in a clear liquidity-rich environment. But there's absolutely no doubt that with speculative activity rising among retail investors, that we are looking at late cycle activity, and that continued outperformance by markets is heavily dependent on access to liquidity. So what happens with banks is important. What happens in terms of high yield spreads is also important. And the consistency of trends is also relevant. And I view the fact that gold shares and gold prices have been in this consolidation for the last few months. It's obviously all of those previous conclusions would lead one to the additional conclusion that gold should really be doing much better. But the reality is that gold did do fantastically well, and it performed admirably between 2018 and 2020. And this is nothing more than a consolidation in the region of the peak from back in 2011. I don't really have much doubt that gold is going to continue to push up on the upside over the course of the medium term. But we're still in a corrective phase in the short term. And as long as we have this liquidity-rich environment, it's likely to act as a tailwind, but we're probably going to have an inflation scare in order to get gold into the next phase of the bull market overall. I also continue to look on Bitcoin as a lightning rod for speculation. Now, we had a somewhat larger pullback over the course of the last week, and it has recouped most of it. When we look at the size of the breakout, it's truly impressive, although not quite as impressive as the big move up that we had in 2017. In terms of the consolidations we've seen since March of this year, they've been limited to about 20%, and the pullback we saw over the last 2 weeks from peak to trough was 27%. So therefore, that's an inconsistency. It also pulled back into the underlying trading range, which was an additional consolidation, inconsistency. Now that level around 30,000 will absolutely have to hold if this is still going to be a consistent advance. The one big difference between Bitcoin now and Bitcoin back in 2015 and 16 is the price is at significant multiples of where it was back then. It requires a lot more money to move the price today than it did then. It also means that Bitcoin is unlikely to peak on its own. So when Bitcoin eventually does peak, it's likely to act as at least a coincident indicator, but potentially a lead indicator for trouble in the wider stock market. And that reason alone is a good reason for monitoring the trend. So it wasn't quite able to hold the move back up to 40,000 in here today, but the more important level is 30,000. If it takes that out, then I think that will be rather bad news for just about all assets. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.